Before I begin today's episode, I want to talk about a special app, podcast app. As most of you know, there's never been more incredible podcasts to listen to. There are so many great podcasts out there. Some you fall in love with right away, others take more time to warm up to. However, most podcast apps treat all of your shows the same, clogging your phone with downloads of stuff you're only marginally interested in. But with Castro, you can finally choose which shows you want downloaded and ready to listen at the top of your list, as well as letting you pick and choose from your occasional listens in your podcast inbox. This and many other powerful features let you put your listening on autopilot. The app is free to use. You can download it today on the App Store. And now to our today's episode. Hey listeners, welcome back. Can I just say how grateful I am for this audio family of mine? I honestly don't know who you guys are, whether you are a parent or a student, whether you prefer coffee or tea, but I take so much solace and pleasure in knowing that there are people out there who are listening to my show. It really puts a smile on my face. And knowing that the voices and stories we are sharing on this platform, whether ordinary or curious, are resonating with everyone out there and are being heard, this makes me so happy. So, how is everyone doing on their New Year's resolution? I'll be honest, I am not making any resolutions this year. What I saw last year was that resolutions seldom materialize, and it is almost futile to make any resolutions. And I just want to see how 2021 turns out, and I don't even want to be bothered by setting up expectations and just take one day at a time. That being said, just as we need to partake in rest and reflection, there is so much work to be done. Immigrantly is on its 9th season. Wow, can you believe it? And we have an excellent lineup for this season. Last week, if you guys are our regular listeners, you heard from Ethna Lubeth and Karma Chavez about the intersectionality of sexuality and migration. This week, we have a special guest. He is a journalist, a public speaker, a parent, someone who I found equally bold and funny, with a lot on his mind and a lot to share. Wajahat Ali is the type of public figure we need more of these days. He's a Pakistani-American who challenges the status quo and our assumptions, who chooses change over disillusionment, whose socio-political commentary is every bit interesting and most of the times hopeful. I have not always seen eye to eye with his publications and line of work. It's because we are two different individuals. We have different thoughts on how the progressive movement should build its coalition and which voices are in need of amplification. But like me, he has thought long and hard about what is wrong with this country. From the stereotyping of ethnic and religious minorities to the outright inhuman executive orders of the government.
2016 happened, I told my speaking agency, I said, send me to the Trump countries. Send me to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. I'll talk. I'll give it a shot. I'll listen, but I will not apologize for my narrative and I'll share my narrative, which is what I did.
Wajahat writes from a place of empathy and innovation. His articles, tweets, talks all point to a path forward by enriching our understanding of people and communities in this country. I should probably stop myself there and let Wajahat introduce himself. Without further ado, let's start.
Hi,
I was born and raised in this country, and Dadi Dada used to live with us. There's a video they found of us and the cousins. We're like 4 or 5. You would literally think we're Karachi street kids. And I say this as a compliment because we're just talking hardcore Urdu. I didn't speak any English until I went to first grade.
Wow.
They put me in ESL. And so your kids will learn. Just go ahead and just unleash it on them.
I speak Pashto. Urdu is not my first language.
Oh, that's tough.
So I would rather teach them Pashto, which I've been trying to do. But my husband speaks Urdu and then he speaks Punjabi as well. So we have like 3-4 languages in the household. And believe you me, my kids haven't learned even one.
Yeah, so there's going to be a salad of just words that they'll know. I do think there's something about all 5-6 adults speaking Urdu. Then just it helped us absorb. My problem is, it's my regret. I still have time. My son is 6, Nuseba's 4, and we have a baby. How old are your kids?
My kids are teenagers.
Okay, so you know what, though? But if you guys take classes, it's still possible.
Yeah, I guess I've been lazy. My sister, stuck to Pashto. Her kids speak Pashto fluently, and they are really happy. But unfortunately, yeah, I should have just taught them one language and not created, as you said, the salad of languages.
Sure.
You're a household name for a lot of people, Pakistani Americans to start, then New York Times enthusiasts. I'm sure there are some out there listening to our podcast. I believe millennials, I think they follow you as well. And the list goes on. But for those who may not know you, I'm sure there are a few who may not. Could you introduce yourself? Where did you grow up? Where are you now? And maybe just add your favorite ice cream flavor to it.
Most do not know me. And if they see me, they're like, how come Hasan Minhaj gained weight and lost hair? So I'm the guy they'll get when Hasan, Riz, Ali Velchi, Mehdi Hasan, and Mindy Kaling say no. Then they bring me as the guest. And that's what happened here right now, which is fine. This is my station in life, and I'm very grateful for it. I am simply a writer trying to figure out what he wants to be when he grows up. I was born and raised in the Bay Area, California, Fremontistan, which is the second Karachi. I was born in 1980 in Fremont to Pakistani Muslim parents who thankfully came here after the 1965 Immigration Nationality Act. My father at that time was 18 years old. And as soon as this country, United States, lifted its very restrictive embargo on those visas that were put in place in the 1920s, because at that time, the invaders to this country weren't Mexicans and Muslims. It was Irish Catholics and Jews and Eastern Europeans. So 1965, the Immigration Nationality Act was huge because it basically gave an opportunity for people like my parents, my father in particular, and his older brother, Sultan Uncle, to come here, right, on student visas. And Abu came here and he said, okay, I'll get the best education and I'll make my mark and I'll raise pesa. And then eventually I'll go back and help Pakistan.
Yeah, we all think that.
Yeah. And that was his hope, right? But then, but then what happened was then he brought Dadi. Then he brought Dada. Ah. Then he brought Papo. Then he brought Chachi and Chacha. And then Dadi, my grandmother at that time, she's like, okay, beta, you're 30 years old. We've given you too much of a leash. Now you have to go get shadied. And so great story. He saw my mom's photo in a Pakistani newspaper that my dada used to get delivered to him from Pakistan.
Interesting.
Yeah, from my father's telling, he'll never say stuff like, oh, I found her pretty and attractive. He said, I found her interesting. And Ummi was in the paper because she had topped her class in some studies. And she goes, who's that? Coincidentally, my dada said, oh, she's Hashmi's daughter. I knew a Hashmi. It might be the same one. And then Dada was like matchmaker and did behind the scenes investigation. And then lo and behold, it was the same Hashmi, Iqbal Hashmi, that he knew from Karachi. And they passed the bio data to him somehow. And so when my father went to Karachi, they had the meeting. They met once. And I'll just share this quick story. And everyone came out and Nani was there. Nana was there. The mitai comes out. The chai comes out. Then my mom comes out and they're all sitting awkwardly. And my father's only talking to my Nana, my mom's father. And my mom's sitting there and she goes, well, you came here to talk. Talk. Don't you have
questions? Wow.
and then my Nani, her mom, looked at her with those Pakistani eagle eyes burning into her skull and like kicking her underneath the table. But my father, I think he smiled and his decision was finished, and he knew, and then 11 days later, they were married, and they came here. And so the reason why I say that is a lot of people, you know, they say they burn the boat when they come here. They assimilate. I joke that my family brought the boat inside the home. My parents just couldn't care less that I was born and raised in America. They didn't care at all about assimilation. They're like, we're going to name you Wajahat. Which is...
Yeah, that's a tough name.
And, you know, growing up, I'm like, why couldn't you have known me? Like, name me like Wilbur or Wally or like Waleed even. They're like, nay, Wajahat. You know, it's a very common name in America, you know, Wajahat. And they didn't teach me English at all. And I didn't know English until literally I went to school. And I think it's hilarious that even though I was born and raised in America, I had to take English as a second language in the first grade. And I ended up graduating with an English major from UC Berkeley and became a lawyer, and now I'm known as a writer. And so that, I think, is a very quintessential American story.
That's so interesting. What inspired you to get into writing, by the way?
So that's a very good question. I believe I always had the tendency towards creativity and art and storytelling. And this is where I'm very lucky that my Pakistani immigrant parents, who were very traditional in many ways with Islam and culture and Khana and language, food and language, were very unorthodox in their parenting approach. Because as you know, it's not just Pakistanis and many immigrant parents, Jewish parents also. We came here, our grandparents came here, we suffered, and we did not suffer and work this hard for you to become a stupid English major. You have to become a doctor or an engineer. Or somehow you become a businessman and make lots of money. And when I was 10, I wrote a story for fifth grade. And it was Miss Peterson in fifth grade said, everyone has to write a one-page fictional story. I wrote a 10-page story. And she gave me an A++++, and then she made me recite that story in front of the homeroom. I was a very shy, very healthy, big-boned, which is a nice way of saying fat. I was very fat, only Pakistani, only Muslim kid. And I begged her, I said, please, no. And she goes, no, recite the story. And it was the first time ever where I had the audience, which were my classmates who used to make fun of me, under my spell. Like they were clapping at the right parts, they were laughing at the right parts, they were quiet at the right parts, and they loved it. I brought that story home and Abu read it. In the kitchen. I remember this vividly. He was, you know, we were just in the kitchen and Abu read it while sitting at the dining table drinking chai and my mom was just cleaning up. And Abu finishes it and he goes, Beta, you have a talent. You should think about becoming a writer. And I remember my mom ran from the kitchen and said, but Beta, first become a doctor. So, that's a true story. But you know, they were always very encouraging. And I was just this dorky kid. And growing up, you know, I always wanted to do the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I wanted to, but I wasn't built that way. No one invited me to do it. So I was like a good dorky kid. And I had a good dorky Muslim Pakistani friend, Kashif. And my parents, like typical immigrant parents, always thought that if they left us alone anywhere, we would be the ones kidnapped. It's like an immigrant. It's like a Pakistani immigrant like thing. Like out of thousands, I always just say, out of thousands of kids, why do you think like the child molesters and kidnappers would choose me? Like, Beta, we don't trust anybody, but we trust Kashif. So you can go hang out with him and in his house. So me and Kashif's mom was the same way. She goes, we trust Wajahat's parents. So we were stuck. And we used to just, in the summer, just make movies in the late 80s and 90s. So we picked up his father's old, heavy, used to be these clunky 30-pound cameras. You used to put it on your shoulder, and after 5 minutes, your shoulder used to ache. So we made videos with that, and we ended up writing and directing and starring it and editing it. And so we used to screen it for our families. We used to just laugh and thought it was the most hilarious thing. And I think that the stuff that we do as children that we don't acknowledge, right, are the building blocks, I think, often for our future, especially if you're creative. And the person who helped me connect the dots was my director for my play. And she said, you know, even though you think you've never gone, quote unquote, training, you made movies with Kashif. You wrote these stories. You did improv comedy in high school. You did theater in college. These were all you just building the blocks of your career. And somehow in the back of the thing I'll say is this, and I think many children of immigrants will appreciate this. You just realized in our communities that you had to be doctor, engineer, businessman. That's it.
Yeah.
And there was no model of success. There was no narrative. And so in the back of my mind, ever since I was a kid, I knew I wanted to do this, what I'm doing now. But I was like, you know, I'll just become a doctor, I guess. And it ended up that I chose to become a lawyer to add to my special talents. But even in law school, without realizing what I did for fun was write plays, and I had my professors star in them.
But Jahal, do you think there's some truth to it when immigrant parents expect their kids to be lawyers and doctors and engineers, given that they leave their homes, they come here, they don't have the same support structure or society that they grew up in. And the only way in their minds their kids can succeed in life is doing something that other kids are not doing. As a parent, I am probably more like your parents. I've let my kids decide what they want to do. And my husband and I argue about this a lot because he's an engineer. My father is an engineer. My brother is an engineer. I'm surrounded by engineers in my house. But when he talks about why it's important to have quote unquote real skill set, I do get why they're saying that. What do you think?
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't leave the conversation there. I don't do it just to make fun of them, even though it's funny. And
it is funny, though.
But the thing is, this is why, right? So, yeah. And this is where, especially as you grow older, you empathize more, because as a parent, as a father, right, our default system as a parent is security for our children. That's what it is.
Exactly.
We want to protect. And our parents didn't have options, and they didn't have the checklist, and they didn't have the support system. And the interesting thing is, as we get older at this age, you know, we meet those parents and we talk to them, and they open up and you learn things about them. And so I had this conversation with Kasia's father, who, you know, I just had memories of him as being this Spartan Desi uncle, right? But interestingly, in the last few years, especially when I did the play, he just opened up a little bit more, and he said, you know, Berta, what I always wanted to be when I grew up, I'm like, engineer. You were an engineer in the womb. Like, what else? He goes, no. He goes, I always wanted to be an architect. And I was like, what? He goes, I always wanted to be an architect. That was my dream. But I came to this country, just like your father, post-1965. And I had to give Pesa back to my mom, and I had to help the family. And I said, Tika, I have two options. I could become a doctor or an engineer. And I was good at math. And so that was the path. And so for our parents' generation, it is like we have created this checklist. This is the checklist of success. This is a tough country. We have done everything so life for you is easier than it was for us. This is, quote unquote, safe. Choose safety and security, and, you know, you'll be okay. The pushback to that, I say, is if you think about it, you guys were the trailblazers who left everything. There was no security in America.
There wasn't, yeah.
You literally left your family, your culture, your traditions, your security blanket, and you came here as young kids, not knowing anything, as brown folks with silly names in the 60s and 70s, where there were no real diversity courses. There was no, you know, critical race theory. And you guys took that risk and you made it. And so for our generation, our challenge, and also for our survival in this country, is that some of us need to bust out of that safe cocoon and go and become teachers, elected officials, journalists, and tell our story, or else we will become marginal and extinct. And so it's a push and pull, but you have to be empathetic. And I am empathetic as to why they were the way they were.
Our story is not very different from your parents who came in 1965 or so. We had same dreams and aspirations. We came here for college, thought we would go back. We didn't. Although I agree with you, for me, maybe because we are a different generation from your parents' generation, I do believe that it's so important for Muslims to be in advocacy and activism and do the kind of stuff that you're doing and so many others are doing, so that our voices are heard. Because being doctors and engineers gives us safety. It doesn't amplify our voices, though.
There you go. And it gives us safety. It gives us financial security. It gives you the, quote unquote, the American dream.
Yeah.
with the American warts and the American nightmare along with it, and the American and the American elitism and classism and prejudices that come along with it too. The baggage, there's negative baggage as well, but it also, it doesn't diversify your potential, your talent. It doesn't help. It doesn't make you the protagonists, really, in some ways, of your story. Your story is still being told to you by others.
Exactly.
And we've seen it, right? Like, you've seen it through 4 years of the Trump administration. Some of us now are the boogeymen and the villains. And if you don't enter that space is ceded to those who unfortunately want you excised from the story, want you removed from the story, right?
And so
it's not enough just to be the nice doctor who gets the nice house, who lives in the suburbs and has the Mercedes and thinks that the Goras, the whites, will accept me.
And we've learned, let's
be blunt, 9/11, the terror attacks made many of our community members and our elders, it was a forced rude awakening that, I'm not white. I'm not accepted. My doctor degree, my engineering degree, my suburban house, my Mercedes, my BMW, my Honda minivan is still not enough for me to be seen as one of us. I'm still seen as them. And that was a rude awakening for, I think, many immigrant parents and community members who thought that they had achieved the American dream and they were now on the right side of the gate in the suburban community.
So, Wajahat, let's talk about being a Muslim, because that identity, I'm sure, is one that you think about constantly. You write about it a lot. As someone who's also Muslim and person of color, it's almost impossible not to be reminded by some external trigger. And we have seen in recent months and years that there is a lot of activism by minority groups for minority rights, by young progressives and allies mostly. What do you see happening in America right now with Muslim communities? Is there a progress? How do you see us grappling with the notion of who represents us?
Yeah, so what's happening right now, it's a very important, difficult crisis for our communities, right? And I believe old models will have to reform or die. New models will have to work with some of the old hands in creating this new frontier. And what I mean by that is in some aspects of our Muslim communities, we were in survival mode. It reminds me of the white evangelical Christians without power and influence. It's like the center will not hold. All things will fall apart. We have to be very reactionary, anti-modernity, you know, wear our religion on our sleeve and we can get by. And we saw that we don't have the ability to do that, right? You have to expand the tent. The fear of expanding the tent then is the age-old fear that then we will integrate and assimilate and lose everything. We will lose our culture and our religion. You see, I mean, we'll become American and we'll become like the Jews where we'll be split apart. There'll be no real gatekeeper and we have to be the gatekeeper. So you're seeing this tension within Muslim communities, Muslim organizations, with Muslim leaders that a lot of young folks are saying, this doesn't work for me. We need new models and we need to branch out and you don't have authority over me. And you see a clamping down, right? Like a desperate clamping down. And what I've always said is the only way to make it in America for our communities is that you have to expand the tent. You have to expand the tent of this thing called American Islam. And I would also say community. And what I mean by that is, first and foremost, within our own communities, you cannot ignore Ismailis. You cannot ignore people who are secular. You cannot ignore people who are religious. You cannot ignore people who are now identifying as both Muslim and gay, even if you might not like it. You cannot ignore Black Muslims, Arab Muslims, Desi Muslims. You cannot ignore those who are poor, right? And secondly, you cannot ignore people who are your fellow neighbors. You can no longer be comfortable in your gated community because you realize that gated community does not protect you. They're coming after you. And they're coming after those who look Muslimy. The first hate crime after 9/11 was Balbir Singh, a Sikh man. And Sikh community members are saying the same thing, is that we can no longer get away with saying, we're not, that's the Muslim there, go get him, not us. It doesn't, bigots don't care. Trump doesn't care. And so there's a realization, especially for this young community, that we have to be, not necessarily politically, but we have to be more progressive, more engaged, more active. We have to go into uncomfortable spaces and we can no longer be hypocrites and demand people fight against Islamophobia if we're saying, oh, look at that Kalu and why do they do that stuff? Or look at that that lazy Mexican or these disgusting gays. I'm not going to help them. It doesn't work that way. And so this is the tension, I think, that's happening right now with our communities, in addition to the immense pressure of being scapegoated and targeted by the president of the United States of America. It's immense pressure. And will that pressure break us, or will that pressure invite us to become a diamond and be the best versions of ourselves? It remains to be seen. But I do think the tension has to be mentioned right now.
What you're saying makes a lot of sense. But at the same time, some narratives are not created by Muslim communities per se. For instance, the African-American Muslim narrative, I feel like we see media and journalistic institutions push for Muslims being only South Asian or Arabs. And the reason, what I understand, is it's difficult to deny Americanness to African-Americans, right? And to other Muslims, to basically say Muslims are othered, you have to bring forth communities that can be othered. African-Americans cannot be othered. So that's one. So I think it's not just Muslims othering different communities within the broader Muslim community, but it's also how narratives are shaped. And to your point about gays and lesbians, I am absolutely in agreement with that, because what I see is Muslims talking about, oh, we should ally with LGBTQ plus community. What they don't realize is that by saying that, they are erasing the LGBTQ plus community that exists within the Muslim community. LGBTQ plus community is very much part of Muslim identity in some ways, right?
Yeah, so working backwards, that's a very astute observation, right? And this is the tension. And just so interesting that you brought this up. On a WhatsApp group, someone sent me this trailer for a movie that's coming out, a very low-budget, independent, harmless movie written and directed and produced by apparently an American Muslim man about a gay Muslim doctor, and he is now in a relationship with like a white man. That's, it looks like one of those rom-com independent movies. And it's just like the most harmless little movie. I'm like, okay, whatever, I saw the trailer. But then within Muslim circles, you're seeing it spread on Facebook, and the messages are like, this is what we've become. This is what the normalization of this type of indecency has done. Look at these narratives. And I'm like, there's a pandemic. Our president's trying to become a fascist. There's income
he
inequality.
He is a fascist. Yeah. He is a fascist.
There's climate change. There's racism. Guys, this is one small independent movie that no one will watch, but you see the immense backlash. And you're like, we're not even ready in our community to talk about premarital heterosexual sex, which happens because there's human beings. And we say, what will people say? And no one talks about it. So you live a fiction where you smile your white smile and you show your white teeth and everything's perfect. And you have just pray it away and be a good Muslim. And you don't mention not just the challenges that exist within your own community or the people who exist within your own community. And we have realized, and moving backwards now to the first part of your question, that that is not sustainable, because thanks to social media or thanks to the current political social climate, people are not going to stay quiet. People will be like, I'm not going to give up my Muslim identity just because I'm secular. And how can you stop them? And you saw a lot of secular folks say something about Trump in the last 4 years has made me identify with being Muslim. Example, Fareed Zakaria, who wrote an essay about it, right? He said, I've never, we were very secular. Yeah, I'm Muslim. I never talked about it. I'm not practicing. But there's something about this climate in the last 4 years that makes me want to claim it. And so how are you going to say no to them? And who are we to deny?
To say no to them.
And as a Muslim, as a practicing Muslim, who am I to deny Allah to anyone?
Exactly.
At the same time, I understand the tension. And this is where sometimes progressives might say, where are you going with this, Wajahat? I'm going to say this also. You don't have to agree with gay marriage. There will be Muslims and people in this country who say, this is haram to me. This is a sin. And that's okay. That's fine. People hate religion. I don't care. I was the token Muslim growing up. I went to all boys Catholic high school, Jesuit high school. Do I think everyone liked Islam or Muslims? No, but they let me be and I let them be. They respected me at the end of the day, right? And that's fine. And I feel like that level of expansion can happen without you compromising your morals and identity. And that's the tension that Muslims believe, that if I accept this movie, this little independent movie made about some gay doctor trying to find love, I'm somehow opening the floodgates to sin, and my son is going to wear a dress and change his pronoun, and my daughter is going to get a tattoo of her lower back and take vodka shots. I mean, I'm being honest. That's how people think. It's like, it's over. It's all finished. It's done. And I'm saying, number one, that's already happening in your communities. Yeah. You have to be more open about it. And I think if you accept people, you can't change people. You know, you can't change it, but you can at least expand the tent and see the diverse communities and ally yourself with Muslims in these communities and push us all forward. And at the same time, going to your second question is, you can acknowledge that there are active forces at play in this country that I have researched and written about who are actively trying to marginalize all of us. And it requires a multicultural coalition of the willing for us to survive, you know, that a rising tide floats all boats. And some, I think, especially the youth, is understanding this.
Are you ready to co-create the world we want to live in? Then I recommend join the community listening to Our Body Politic, political podcast that's by and for women of color, much like Immigrantly, with everyone welcome to join the feast. The show offers a new view of the news, making politics personal with host Farai Jadea, a veteran Black woman journalist who has reported all over the U.S. from Standing Rock to Air Force One and covered every presidential election from 1996. Each week, with her passion and decades of experience, Farai gets real with women you need to hear from, like Senator Tammy Duckworth, Representative Rashida Tlaib, journalist Amna Nawaz, author N.K. Jemisin, and more. So if you want your politics news to lift you up and be useful in your daily life, then listen to Our Body Politic. You can also help them shape the show and the future by sharing your thoughts with them. You can subscribe to Our Body Politic wherever you listen to podcasts. So let's talk about something in the same context. I want to pivot to a piece you wrote for The Atlantic a while back. It's called A Muslim Among Israeli Settlers. As I was researching your work, I came across it. I read it. I was struck by the writing, and I want to talk through it as someone who's also Muslim and has a perspective. It may not be the same as yours. But before that, I want to start by asking you, what do you think the critics of this particular article didn't quite understand about your intentions?
See, I don't know if intentions even matter. I mean, I think intentions matter, but it's also about actions, right? And so once you put a piece out there, it's fair game. I'll tell you very quickly how that piece came about, and very quickly I'll try to honor the critics of the piece also. Hmm. So the piece came about is that Atlantic wanted me to write something, and we kept trying to go back and forth, trying to figure out what to do. I had like two or three meetings with Jeffrey Goldberg, who's the editor-in-chief of Atlantic. I was in his office, and I saw a photo of him dressed up like, you know, like a Pathan man. And it was like a black and white photo. I'm like, what are you doing? And he goes, oh, that was like my first story. I was in Pakistan. I was like a Jewish reporter. I went and I kind of like embedded myself with these freedom fighters who ended up, some of them ended up being the Taliban. And I kind of just knocked on their door and said, hey, can I just hang around with you? And that became my first story. And I said, you know, it's so interesting is that white guys and Jewish guys always get to write about our extremists. We never get to write about like your extremists or white extremists. And he paused and he said, you know, I know you've studied with Jews and you've gone to Israel and Palestine, but would you ever want to go talk to settlers and do a piece on them? And I said, sure. He goes, listen, I don't know if you ever talked to settlers. But some of them ain't nice. And I'm like, I know. I talked to a few of them. I've had my very interesting encounters. He says, and I think there might be a story there, you know, you as a journalist, but also with your background going and trying to find the motivation of this modern settler and this modern settler movement. And he goes, look, I can tell you, because he's, you know, he's Jewish American. He cares about Israel. He's been critical of Israel. He goes, I can tell you that the writings on the settlers aren't really that good. It's like, it's much more nuanced than what people think, but in a way that's also a bit scarier. So I said, let's go. I'll do it. And so I went based upon the trust that I had built working with Jewish communities, because they don't open themselves up. And right. I had people in Israel, Jewish allies, said, listen, this is the irony. All of them who Googled me said, this guy seems to hate Israel. this guy's pro-Palestinian activist. I don't know. Are you sure? He goes, no, no, look, he has his harsh criticisms of the occupation and of Israeli policies, but we know him. He'll be fair. And so I went as a reporter. I did not go as an activist or as Wajahat-Ali the Muslim. This is number one. I go there. I reported what I got. And I also had to limit my focus because it's impossible, right? So even I had to cut 50,000 words into 10. Instead of going to Gaza or East Jerusalem, I focused mostly on the West Bank. And it was a Muslim among the settlers in the West Bank. That's the piece. So the thing is, overwhelmingly, the piece got very good reaction. And the funny thing is in the Atlantic, when we showed it to, like, you know, just people who have no vested interest in it, aside from just being, I guess you could say, spectators, they said, wow, man, the settlers look crazy. They look extreme. Now, the interesting thing is when the article dropped, I got hit from many Muslims and some Palestinian activists who knew me within some of the organizational Muslim communities. Does that make sense? like the acronyms and the groups. And for them, it was twofold. One, it's a betrayal. How could you, Wajahat-Ali, do this? And number two, you have normalized and humanized the settlers. And then my only response to that was, look, I went as a reporter. I don't think I normalized. What they wanted was this. They wanted a 10,000-word nonstop bash. Bash, 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 bash. I didn't do that. But I think, and now, you know, 2 years removed, and having talked to audiences, I'm talking about diverse audiences, the feedback I get is the following from Jews. I don't agree with your conclusions. That was a very hard read, but I appreciate you doing it, and that was very sobering. Other Jews say, I'm glad you did that. They're freaks. And the final thing I say is I got so much heat for it in the first month after it released, but I was just joking with people because how Israel-Palestine, just talking about it is a third rail. I got this email 2 weeks ago, random email from a publicist who was talking to me about something else, but she sent me another email. She says, listen, I'm a Black female in D.C., and I'm a Palestinian solidarity member. And I just saw your work on it. And I said, thank you so much for doing it because not many people bring to light what's actually happening. So I did a joke with my wife. I'm like, wow, fast forward 2 years, I get this compliment from a progressive activist. Last month, I get this compliment from a former settler who lived in the West Bank. And she said, it made me rethink my entire experience. I'm still thinking about it. And now, as a result of that piece, for those of you who don't know, I'm officially quasi-excommunicated from Muslim spaces.
So here's my take on it, at least my observations. First, based on your account of the conversations with the settlers, I'm curious to know as to why, in your opinion, the majority of the population dismisses the occupation, both as a term, as an action, with such blatant ease. Like, there is no remorse or acknowledgement at all, right? And I'm approaching this from a human rights activist's perspective. I've always looked at Palestine-Israel issue from that. I honestly don't think you and I have the skin in the game. We are not Palestinians. It's not our lived experience. So for me to make a judgment on what should or shouldn't be, to me, it seems like I'm overstepping my boundaries. But I am interested in your response to why do you think it's so easy for them, despite UN and member states recognizing Palestine's right to self-determination, despite you and I knowing that there is half a century long brutal occupation. Why do you think that is the case?
I think it's based on narrative. A lot of it is based on narrative. I mean, you'll be surprised. And I joked about it in the piece that some people take me back 5,000 years. I'm like, some people go back 3,500 years. Some people go back 2,000 years. Some people go back to 48. Some people go back to 67. But it's narratives. And they believe that they also have a rightful claim. And many of them on the deal say Palestinians also have a claim, but we also have a claim.
Yeah, but that doesn't take away from the occupation.
I don't disagree with you. Look, you and I don't disagree, right? But it's like this. I think there was a rabbi who said it to me because he grappled with it in an honest way. And he says, sometimes you just don't see. I'm like, how? And I said, how? How can you not see occupation? He goes, sometimes you don't see. I'm like, how? It's literally right outside your home. He goes, let me give you an example. He says, racism in America. How can you not see? Anti-Black police brutality. How can you not see? a segregation. How can you not see? And I'm like, that's okay. And that's not a rationalization, but it just shows you that human beings are sometimes comfortable not seeing unpleasant narratives and realities that contradict their comfort and their narrative.
But do you think it has also to do with the fact that they can get away with it? Because when we talk about racism in America, white folks don't see racism because they can get away with it.
Well, it's about power and privilege.
Yeah.
And so who has the power and the privilege? And power makes you blind to your privilege, and it makes you blind to the abuses of that privilege. And so that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is rampant systemic disinformation and dehumanization. To the point where my filmmaker, you know, he was Jewish American, and he was very open-minded, but he had never gone to the West Bank. It was interesting just to observe his journey. As he was seeing this, he goes, that's not supposed to happen. They're not supposed to do that. IDF's not supposed to be here. And at the end, he said, wow, man, I've been fed certain things my entire life. You know, it's like Seth Rogen's very controversial comment that he made a month or two ago about Israel.
Where
I'm paraphrasing him, but he says, like, we've been taught a lie. And you see, like, white people in America saying, oh, shoot, white privilege. You're right. You know, and so to answer your question, that is kind of the justifications. And I didn't agree with any of the justifications. The other justification, which is the old school justification, which I think people rationalize, but I also think is BS. I think you agree with me, is the security justification.
Oh, absolutely.
Which goes back to racism and colonialism. And I said it. Exactly. I said, you sound like a colonialist in the sense that I will wait for the savages to prove to me that they're civilized. And then and only then I will lift the boot off their neck, knowing full well that then I will be safe. And I said, don't you realize that until you take the boot off their neck, you're never going to have any peace? You have to take the boot off the neck. But what they say, look, you don't have to agree with this. This is what I'm saying. You have to understand why people think the way they think. That's what I'm telling you. You know, I didn't agree with it. It's like, why are people behaving the way they're behaving? It's because they believe that if they take the boot off the neck of the Palestinians, and some of the settlers were honest with me, they said, we have committed an injustice.
But we are fine with it.
No. It's like this. Someone said this to me. It was very powerful. My realization of my dream has come at the expense of the Palestinian people. My homeland and my realization of Israel has come at the shattering of the Palestinian people.
But here's the thing. Recognizing the fact really doesn't change ground realities, right? Look, I know there are people in the Jewish community who are fighting for the Palestinian cause. I, in fact, interviewed Merav Zonzin last year. She's a journalist, someone who surprisingly calls herself a Zionist, but she is one of the most vocal supporters of Palestinian right to self-determination. So I get it. There are people out there who are supporting both sides and who understand how important it is to have a two-state solution or to give Palestinians the right to have their own state.
You know, so what I was saying is I don't agree with the justification of the person I was saying. I was going to finish it up by saying, but we're at this point right now where if we end the occupation, I want to know that I feel safe. And so you go in this endless circle. And this endless circle, right? And then what's also interesting, and this is why I'm so glad you mentioned that last point, these nuances do not exist sometimes in our community. I'm going to be blunt about our own Muslim communities. This is what I've heard. I won't talk to a Zionist. I won't talk to any Zionist. We don't deal with any Zionist organizations. And what I tell people is it's how people talk about Muslims. They think we're all the same. There are different degrees and people and communities. There's Zionists who I met who are against the occupation. There's Zionists who I met and I interviewed who believe that there's immense injustice. There's Zionists who I've met who say, go back to 67. There's Zionists who feel even 67 sucks because 48 was the Nakba, but now it's like, you know, 70 years on and, you know, it's like at least there'll be some remedy, right? And those, quote unquote, Zionists are not seen as true Zionists by other Zionists. Do you see what I'm saying? And so that's, those nuances, I'm sorry to say, do not exist within what I would say are the, what I would hope were some of these Muslim communities, and they get pressured by some funders, just like Jewish communities do, And they get pressured by some activists, just like Jewish communities do, to pursue a very harsh litmus test that then closes us off and allows only the most, I won't even say extreme, but the most hardline narratives to come out, where, as you have seen in your outreach, there are Jews who get it, who are Zionists. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do also, is to see if there's any sort of alliance that can be made for what's happening in America right now.
Which, I have to be fair to Palestinians, the problem lies in skewed power dynamic we see between Palestinians and Israelis, and how Palestinians are treated as subhuman and are constantly dehumanized, right? Now, you and I can probably talk to Zionists and appreciate their nuanced approach because, as I said earlier, we don't have skin in the game. We can look at it more rationally. But for Palestinians, in my opinion, it's not as simple, right? Look, I cannot imagine living under an occupation and being denied basic humanity on a daily basis. But I will give you an example of how, even when somebody treats you badly, it's difficult to communicate with them. As a progressive, I find it very difficult to engage with Republicans who denied me my humanity for the last 4 years. And this is a very small example of how humans behave. So if I cannot move past that, I honestly cannot imagine how difficult it must be for Palestinians to get over that barrier of how they are treated.
So in Palestine, for example, It's two different laws for two different people. Palestinians are living under occupation, right, and they're living under military law, right? But then you talk to some Palestinians, and let's be honest, you talk to some Palestinians and say, sometimes the only way forward for us is to make whatever type of engagement we can, knowing full well that there's a power differential. And maybe we can create through some social and cultural works and alliances. Some people say no. Some people say F that. Now, in America, I'm in this interesting position where I did this New York Times piece that went viral last month, where I said I have made the attempt for the past 4 years to go to Trump country. To everyone said, listen to their anguished cries. And I look, in 2016, I covered the election. You and me and most journalists of color said it's not economic anxiety, it's cultural anxiety. Trust me, it's a white lash, it's a white backlash. But economic anxiety, fine, blah, blah, blah. 2016 happened. I told my speaking agency, I said, send me to the Trump countries. Send me to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. I'll talk. I'll give it a shot. I'll listen, but I will not apologize for my narrative, and I'll share my narrative, which is what I did.
Exactly.
So I went and I proactively shared my narrative. I listened. I talked to people. I connected the dots. And I tried to make, I said, listen, this is going to be bad for all of us. This is going to be bad for America. It seems that you want me to suffer in order to feel great again. I want you to have healthcare. I want you to have a living wage. And as we've seen in the past 4 years, especially, and I'll tell you why I wrote that piece, because some people are like, Wajahat, as a person who spent his life bridge building and reaching out and getting shit for it, you know, how could you write that piece? And the way I reconcile it is this. Look, I'll always have my hand reach out across the aisle. I'm that type of person. And I said that in the piece. And even now, even though people want me to suffer in order to feel great again, as a Muslim, I don't want you to suffer because I'm not cruel. I want your children to succeed. But it's come to a point after 2018 and 2020 with what's happening in the United States of America where I literally cannot talk to you because you think I'm a member of the deep state who wants to eat your child. You know, I don't see them as demons. They're not demons. I've talked to them. I've gone to the diners. I've met them. I've interviewed them. They don't have horns on their head, but we are dealing with a right-wing ecosystem that has become radicalized and has unfortunately radicalized a segment of this population. And when I say we're building the multicultural coalition of the willing, and this is where I differ from some people, I say and I acknowledge we're not going to win over everyone. And I do not want to win over everyone. And I don't have time to win over everyone.
Absolutely.
And the analogy I give is the following. 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, Supreme Court case, came down and finally formally outlawed segregation, right? 1957, look at the photo, the Little Rock Nine. Young black girls try to go to a desegregated school. Have you seen those photos and videos?
Yeah.
The National Guard had to be sent out. Look at the community members. Look at those young girls. They didn't have horns on their head, the white girls who were yelling and spitting at them. You fast forward, and I think they've interviewed some of these people, and they said, man, I'm so embarrassed. I'm so ashamed. I was young. That was the culture. That was my mindset. And some of them changed. But some of them never changed, Sadia. Some of them lived and died with that hate in their heart. What I've told people, and it kind of sobers them, is that I believe we have lost a significant, I think we've lost about 20% of this population for our lifetimes. We've lost them. We cannot win over this disinformation battle. It's just gone. And the way I see it is like a virus. You contain the virus and then you inoculate the majority. And through time, you minimize the virus. So it's a double-edged prong kind of strategy that I've employed. And that's how I rationalize me being a bridge builder, but me also agreeing with you and saying, I am not here to defend my humanity for another 4 years.
Exactly. So, Wajahat, let's talk about reality and perception. And I'm pivoting a little. How do you think others perceive you? And how much is it different from who you are?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It depends on community. So the right wing perceives me as, based on their articles, as a fundamentalist, quote, gateway to jihad, who is a, quote, anti-Semite Israel hater, who is also an incubator of radicalism and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an extreme, quote unquote, Islamist force who, as a result of being Muslim and pushing back and being vocal and being in these spaces, I am that type of a threat. Number one. Mm. Number two, a bigoted, anti-conservative, anti-Republican Muslim lefty who is intolerant and unwilling to build bridges, which is so comical because the same folks who say this are the ones who dish out cruelty but always demand civility from the rest of the society, right? From Muslims, it used to be, I think, one of our golden boys, one of the guys who made it, a guy who can write, a guy who can speak, a guy who can defend us, who sold himself out to suck at the teat of Zionist Jewish power in order to make his world and money and bling in the media. And the only reason he is in CNN and New York Times, and I say this quote, these are intelligent people, who many of you know, who literally believe this. The only reason he has succeeded is because he made this Faustian bargain. Other Muslims, he is a non-practicing, almost maybe kafir Muslim who's totally progressive and secular. And I think to others, I think to the majority then, what they tell me at least is, seems like a funny, sharp guy who cares deeply, who loves his kids and his family and video games and pop culture and politics and Bay Area sports and is learning how to cook. And we learn things about different perspectives and communities from following him.
So you talked about your family. I want to talk a little bit about that. Now, you're a proud and vocal dad. I've seen your tweets. And it seems like that's such an integral part of your identity and your life. In fact, I've seen how open you've been about your daughter's cancer diagnosis. I'll be honest with you. It's so refreshing to see somebody be so open about it and have a conversation around mental health, the toll that it takes on parents when their kids are sick. Why do you think you decided to go public with it?
That's a very good question. At first, my wife was very hesitant about it. And naturally so, because she says, you know, do we want to make our family into a narrative as protagonists or characters? You know, it wasn't about lokya bolenge, what will people say? There was no shame involved. It was just how much scrutiny, public scrutiny, do you want to put on your family? And specifically at this very trying time where our daughter was diagnosed a year and a half ago with stage 4 liver cancer, where it was all over her liver and they found a spot in her lung. And it was very advanced. And so I said, listen, I don't have many talents and I don't have many skills, but sometimes I could tell a good story. And I know sometimes how media works. And two things can happen. Right now, we need a liver donor for our daughter. And if we share this story. And especially Allah has given me this platform. And I swear, like, I felt like it was like the heavens opened up and I got that CNN gig. Because we had no money at that time and I had no job. And like, once you're stricken with stage four, I mean, it cancer plays for all the marbles. It doesn't just affect the patient, but especially when you're parents, that your whole life becomes subsumed by it, right? And so I got CNN like a couple of months after that, which was huge for just some money and also a platform. And so I said, two things can happen from here. Number one, we can publicize and maybe someone will be willing to donate a piece of their liver. Hmm. Number two, you can at least bring awareness about hepatoblastoma and maybe it can help some folks. And so it was both selfish and selfless. And as it happened, so many people became invested in Nuseiba and our family's journey that we just kept the story moving. And the story not only led to tangible results in the fact that over 500 people, mostly strangers, signed up to be liver donors, that one individual came up, Sean Zahir, who I didn't know, and had a matching liver. So our daughter's life got saved. But also what happened as a result, and this is why sometimes telling that story and hopefully telling a story well matters, is I've now got messages from people who said, I originally signed up for your daughter, but I ended up matching with someone else. And I gave a kidney. Hmm. I just gave a liver. And I want to thank you and your daughter. And so you think about other lives that have been saved. And also Georgetown said that we never received 500 people. Like we always thought there was a problem of supply and demand. It seems like the supply is there. And we had no idea. And you literally proved to us that, wow, the supply is there. We just have to do a better job of telling the story. And so as a result of Nuseiba's journey, they are now investing in a center called the Center for Living Donors, named after Nuseiba, to expand the services to help donors and recipients at Georgetown. And so you see kind of like, it's like the, kind of like this gift that keeps on giving. And then the final thing I'll say is someone just dropped off a present or just like right before this interview started. And then, and he was really nice. A friend who's also a Christian, he just decided like him and his daughter went and just dropped off all these presents. I'm like, that was so nice of you. And they saw Nuseiba and they're like, we're like, they were just so happy. They're like, we've never seen you before. And we're, look at you and look how great you look. And we've been praying for you and look at you, you look beautiful. Like, and so this little girl, our Nuseiba, our warrior princess, has inspired so many people. And maybe, inshallah, as we say, God willing, as she lives, maybe her journey and her ongoing journey, right? It's a different life, can inspire. If it just inspires one person to be a liver donor, you saved a life.
That's true. And I think it makes people attuned to the fact that we are not perfect, right? And there are limitations to what we can do and what we can't do. When somebody so close to you gets sick, it's a humbling experience on so many levels. I've had quite a few relatives die because of cancer. And that's one disease that really scares the shit out of me.
It's the worst. It's the worst. It's the worst disease possible. It's an indiscriminate killer. It plays for all the marbles. It doesn't care about anything. It's like a creature literally created to annihilate.
That's true. Wajahat, in the end, I often like to end with this question because it returns to the heart of this podcast, particularly. Just as there is not one version of Muslim or immigrant or Pakistani, we established that, there is no one America. What is America to you? And what do you want America to be for your children?
So America is home. When people say, go back to where you came from, which I get all the time, especially in the past 4 years.
Wow.
I tell them, Fremont, California? Really? Can you pay for my rent? Because it's really expensive. Also, America, to me, the vision of America I have, and the best way I can give it is, you know, you talked about my daughter, so I give an analogy with my kids. It's a country where my children with a trisyllabic name and mocha caramel skin, who are Muslim, can have a chance, an opportunity to be whatever they want, regardless of their identity. And once they, inshallah, earn their seat at the dining table, They'll bring their biryani and place it in, in between the meatloaf and the enchilada. Uh-huh. And their job isn't done. They'll look around and they'll look behind them and they'll see another community member who hasn't gotten the seat at the table. And they'll reach across the aisle. Oh, they'll reach down with their power and privilege and lift them up and bring them to the table as well to celebrate and taste the meal. And that, for me, is my vision of how America needs to be.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Wajahat. I know you're extremely busy and you took the time out for us. I am so glad we were able to have this conversation.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Please wear a mask, social distance. The next month is going to be very dangerous and critical, so please be safe.
What an interesting conversation. Wajahat is so funny. He's articulate. He's smart. I had so much fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, don't forget to share. That's how we grow. And you can also subscribe to our Patreon, our GoFundMe, if you want to make one-time donation. And then you have our beautiful merch, our tote bag. Until next time, when I have another incredible guest for you. Take care.